In order that all sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Greetings and welcome to Realizing the View, Part 1, Buddhavachana, Abhidharma, and Madhyamaka. So before we sat, we did introductions, which we didn't record, and Chris gave a wonderful little background of this course and our collaboration in doing this course. And so hopefully we'll sort of paste those together in the recording scheme of things, and that'll go right here, so to speak. But as Chris said, I reached out to him in January of 2023, and there was this text that Trungpa Rinpoche had the translation committee translate back in 1983 by Mipham, the great, called The Lion's Roar of Other Emptiness Gentle. And it's sort of an obscure Madhyamaka topic. And the word was that Rinpoche found it helpful in his path of education, this particular text. And so he asked the committee to translate, and I was part of the committee at the time, and I was at seminary in 83 in Bedford Springs, and a lot of the committee was there, and we had this meeting with them to discuss approaching the text, and basically the conclusion was that the text was very difficult, and the committee had, should probably do a lot of work preparing for translating it, in the form of studying the text with a gentleman named Kempa Paulden Sherab Rinpoche, who is one of the famous two Nyingma Kempa brothers in upstate New York, and a Mipham scholar. So he was invited to and taught at what was then called Rocky Mount Dharma Center for some period of time with the translators. No, down in Crestone. They went down there and lived down there, and I was not able to participate in that, but I was always interested in the text, and they finally did a rough draft of it, and there were many questions, and it seemed really rough because it was difficult to read, and over the years I would bother them about it because it's an important topic. What is Gento? And Mipham is like the paragon of our tradition. The tradition that Trungpa Rinpoche comes from is the Rime tradition that sort of brings together all the traditions of Buddhism in Tibet, but in particular was a forte of the Kagyu Nyingma and of the major amazing tulkus of Eastern Tibet, starting with Jigme Lingpa and coming down through the Kyentses and the Kongchols and the Chokchur Lingpas and Pacho Rinpoche and Mipham. And Mipham was said to be the most incredible scholar and was able to debate the Galupas, you know, so that was of quite some fame that he could successfully win in debates with the Galupas and infuriate them, drive them crazy, which was very intriguing. And that he did that in two texts. One is a commentary in the ninth chapter of the Bodhicharavatara called the Norbu Kedika, the Kedika jewel. I'm not sure what Kedika is, but anyway, and then this text, The Lion's Roar of Gentle. And I doing this Rima Shadra, I continually wanted to do like have a course on that text, and I wanted them to produce it. And I kept bugging them, being primarily Scott Wellenbach, but to some extent Larry Mermelstein. And finally, I saw that Scott taught a course on it at the Tartu Institute some summers ago, I think. And I was like, wait a second, you're teaching it there? But I had asked him if I could use it for a course. It was like, it's draft. I'd rather not. And so finally I got him. He had done it there. I was like, what the hell? And so I said, okay, we'll clean it up. And I got Larry was into the idea of cleaning up, publishing and finishing like old projects. And so he got Scott to do that, and they actually published it, I think like in 2002. And I like said I was going to do a course. I sponsored. I bought a, bought. odd accent there coming in. A whole bunch of copies to give to people, and I will give to all of you if we were able to meet in person when we get to that part of the series. And so then I tried to read. I always thought that it was hard to read because it was a rough translation, and then I discovered it was hard to read because it's a really difficult text. So I was a little stumped, and so then I reached out to my collaborator, Chris Wilcox, said, hey, what do you say we do a course on this? I thought maybe together we could like help unpack the text. And that was in January of 2023, as Chris said, and it was over some time. We gradually came to the realization more and more that we needed to like do the whole background of like what he's talking about, who he's reacting to, and the context for his presentation. And I think I was really into like going all the way back and like filling in all the major texts. And initially I had contemplated it as being the either the end point or the kickoff of this series that was announced in 2002. So I'm gonna screen share. Where is it? So this, in 2022, the idea was Madhyamaka in the Tibetan tradition. We're going to do a whole series of courses on Madhyamaka. And I realized that at that point, a lot of the people in Rima Shadra didn't have the background that many of us others had in the Rima Shadra, having gone through the traditional preparatory material that's used in the Shadra before studying Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka Avatar Introduction to the Middle Way. And so we did a, coaxed people into doing really laborious, very painful, boring classes on these topics, the thing called collected topics, which is like a condensation of Abhidharma, classification, mental states, Loric, the whole, it's like part of, it's a bridge between Abhidharma and Pramana, valid cognition, and the tenets of the various schools. And we use this new series that magically came out at the right time by the Dalai Lama's main translator, Tupten Jinpa, and a group of other Geshes that he brought together. And so the Madhyamaka from, we were going to go into the main text of the Tibetan tradition, which is still my hope, Tsongkhapa's presentation, Dolpopa, some Sakyas, and then culminate in Mipham, and along the way include the Karma by Rongchung Dorje. So we went through all those preparatory courses, and people were, it was extremely exciting. I know Mary Beth was there, Barbara was there, Rob, I think, was there, Chris, Emily's back, and we all had, and Matt, I think, was there for some of that. And we all had huge headaches from those, and we decided to do a text on meditation as like a break. So we did the moonbeams of Mahamudra for five segments, which was amazing. But now we're back on track a little while later. And so, as I said, to properly go through the lines work of Jantung by Mipo, which is very short, it's like 20-page text, we decided to take a parade through the entire history of the Buddhist tradition in the development of what's called the view. And the view, we have basically view, meditation, and conduct. I think we've heard that sort of triad. And in that scheme, view comes first. For most of us, meditation comes first, and conduct, we ideally try to implement or refine as soon as possible. And view can take some time. Sometimes a lot of people never get really to deepen their view and just rely on meditation, which is one possibility. It really is a very profound path of skillful means of the Buddhist tradition to combine these, to combine the view and meditation. And the placement of the view at the beginning of that triad is not by coincidence. It's intentional of like, what are we doing? And from that, we meditate and we work on our conduct. And that comes from the Noble Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path for Noble Ones, which begins with right view and then right intention. And right view in that context is the Four Noble Truths. And so the Buddhist tradition has excelled in refining, clarifying, focusing on the view of the nature of reality. What is our reality? What are we doing? And how are we doing it? And what is this world? And how do we achieve enlightenment? How do we transform the experience of feeling like we're suffering into a different experience? The view plays a key aspect in that. And so tonight, we thought about, Chris and I planned to talk about the view, about view in general and the view, and then to go through, just like go through the material for the three courses, and in particular this course. So I'm gonna kick it over to Chris at this point to start the discussion on view, and then I'll chime back in on the view and what is view and how is it important. And for that, we're gonna have a really good view.
So I think the term view
Of
is,
course.
hey, I think the term view is a really important one, and one that deserves some contemplation. A lot of times, the material that we're going to be talking about in this class gets called Buddhist philosophy, and in fact, the book, the main book that we're going to be reading, in addition to the almost 400-page source book, sorry. Is called the Golden Age of Buddhist Philosophy. So it's an interesting question about whether there is such a thing as Buddhist philosophy and whether that is an appropriate word to be using at all. On one hand, Buddhists are interested in topics such as epistemology, such as ethics, such as ontology, metaphysics, and we're going to be talking about all of those. But their interest is a very different kind of one than what we experience in Western philosophy. Western philosophy is sort of famously, disinterested and appreciation of knowledge for knowledge's sake. Whereas Buddhism, sort of the operating premise of Buddhism, is this idea that wisdom is ultimately what liberates one from suffering. That the reason we feel so much pain in our life is because we fundamentally misperceive reality. And that the way to stop feeling all that pain is to perceive reality more accurately. And that's an interesting analysis that isn't one that necessarily follows. Western philosophy doesn't necessarily have that view that you'll be in less pain if you understand the world more clearly. So there's a sort of urgency and personalness that exists within these questions in Buddhism. And to that end, I think the term view is quite appropriate. It's embodied, it's personal, it's a first person point of view, and similar to the way we colloquially use that term, my point of view, my view on this, my perspective, there's a sense of it coming from where you are. One thing I was saying to Derek, I think yesterday, was that your view is not when you're sitting in your armchair at your most philosophically refined. Your view is what happens when you get out of bed in the middle of the night and trip over a chair on your way to the bathroom. How you talk to yourself about what happened to you, that's a view. So there's the sense of immediacy of it, and it's related a lot with, I think, sort of like intuition or how we directly perceive our world. So what's so unique about Buddhism as opposed to Western philosophy is that there is a technique called meditation by which we can change our minds. So we talk about the three prajnas: hearing, contemplating, and meditating. Okay. So hearing is when you first encounter an idea. It could be through a talk, through a book. And then contemplating is when you study it. You say, okay, does that make any sense? What does that mean? How does this all fit together? And sort of weigh the merits about, is this a good argument or not? Is this true or not? And then those two are sort of shared in the Western tradition, hearing about things and thinking about them. But then within Buddhism, we have meditation. And the idea with meditation is having already made your mind up about what's real and valid. Meditation is a way of working that into your system, so to speak, and very gradually and gently nudging at your, default mode of perception. So there's a sort of optimism about that it's possible to change your mind. So the point of the view as it relates to meditation is not only as a thing to think about, but is really a way of orienting your meditation towards a specific goal. So we have this quote that's at the beginning of our syllabus from the Song of Lodrotaye. When one practices meditation with the view, it is like a Garuda fathoming space. There is no fear and no doubt. The one who meditates without the view is like a blind man wandering the plains. There is no reference point for where the true path is. So the view can really help us orient our meditation. And then I think once we've had meditative experience, the view is a very helpful tool by which we can integrate that experience. So you sit on your meditation cushion and something happens, and then you get up and you have to figure out what on earth it was. And the view is a cognitive conceptual framework by which we can sort of talk to ourselves about what we experience on the cushion. And then ultimately, a tool by which we can communicate with others. So the view becomes a shared language with which we can talk to our teachers, talk to other students, and try to, use community to help us along the path. Derek was going to talk about the four reliances.
He's got his headphones on. He's listening to music and not paying attention to us.
Yeah.
So interesting having a partner that you have to like go along with what you agree to go to talk about. I'm very unused to that. What was it? Personally unreliable? Personally inconsistent, something like that. So one of the unique features of the Buddhist tradition is, as Chris was saying, the whole logic of Buddhism is overcoming suffering through wisdom and achieving enlightenment. And most religions are more like based on faith. Through faith, you shall be delivered, you shall be liberated, something like that, right? And so there's a huge reliance, which is very different, I think, in Buddhism than other traditions of understanding what are we doing? Why are we doing it? What's happening? What is our world? And being critical of what's going on and trying actually to figure it out. The idea that just because somebody else has figured it out and tells us doesn't really do much for us. That's helpful for us to figure it out, that we have to figure it out and understand it and experience it in order to be transformed or liberated. And so we have to go through that process of looking at what our mind is, what our world is, what our experience is, and challenging it and questioning it. And the Buddha very much encouraged that same attitude in his students when they heard him teach, and he created this scheme called the Four Reliances, which is rely on the teaching, not the teacher. So just because there's some amazing teacher in robes who looks radiant and so forth up on maybe a high seat or a throne, doesn't mean their teachings are accurate or helpful. It's the quality of the teaching itself is the most important thing. We all know that the presence of these enlightened beings is also very helpful, but the key is their teaching, not the teacher. Because on the contrary, I think we've all experienced how we can be taught things by unexpected teachers in our lives in many, many circumstances. People who unintentionally teach us things often and are not very much in the role of being a teacher. So it's really the teaching. And in that teaching, the second one is evaluating that teaching based on the meaning, not on the words that are used. Some people are able to use very eloquent language, describe things very well, use big multi-syllable words and have all sorts of references and so forth. But the meaning of those words is again the key part, not the words, but the meaning. And the third reliance is rely on the definitive teaching and not the interpretable or the provisional teaching, which is dramatically a shift from the first two, which are sort of very basic. The third one immediately indicates that some teachings by the Buddha are provisional, interpretable, and some are definitive. And in various places, he clarifies that teachings that are related to a specific person, to a specific instance, to specific circumstances, are not necessarily definitive and universally to be accepted and applied by everybody. Often teachings are very specific. Many teachings also are given from the point of view of a beginner, of doing things in a certain way that maybe later on you would change as an older student. Either the way you do things or the way you view things. And so you might speak to a complete beginner or teach a complete beginner differently than you might a more advanced student. And those descriptions might actually be different. Those teachings might actually be contradictory. The Buddha, you remember, was enlightened at 35, and he lived until almost 81. So he was teaching for, if I can do my math still, like 45 or 6 years. That's a really long time. And he walked around and he met thousands and thousands of people. And he taught a lot of different things in a lot of different contexts that were intentional to those situations, those people, and those contexts. And he may have, or in fact, he did say things in some places that were different than he said in other places. And when confronted with that, he said it's because of the situation, the circumstances. And so he was forcing his students, us, to have that critical mind of how do we understand a teaching? Is it something that is contextual, interpretable, or is it something that's definitive and universal? And in doing so, in presenting that challenge to us, on the one hand, there's the interpretable that I spoke about a bit, but on the other hand, there's the definitive. And in different traditions of Buddhism, there's vastly different teachings that are attributed to the Buddha. I think we all know this, that some traditions that are alive today do not accept major parts of the literature of other traditions. In particular, the type of the Buddhists, rather, who are in South Asia, basically do not accept the teachings of the Mahayana Sutras as being actually the teachings of the Buddha. And in those different teachings, there's dramatically different statements about the nature of reality, about the nature of all the different aspects of reality. And we have to use our critical intelligence to see which of those presentations of the nature of reality are lower down on a sort of ladder of some implied hierarchy of understanding of the nature of reality, and that some are sort of more advanced, more refined. It immediately sets up that scheme of looking at teachings as having a quality of ascending a scale. And in particular, I think we all know that the Buddhist tradition in Tibet received all of these teachings from India. They regarded all of them as completely true. And there were many contradictions between those teachings. And so they had to, they really took to this scheme of the Four Reliances very seriously and tried to figure out what teachings were more definitive than other teachings. They were not alone in doing this. This was a common feature of Chinese Buddhism that also passed into Japan, Korea, and Vietnam, which is more based on sutras. They had this various schools were dedicated to sutras, which was the most ultimate sutra. Many of them had a scheme of a number of sutras that were arranged in ascending order, culminating in the sutra of their school as being the most profound. And I thought Dzogchen Khyentse Rinpoche phrased this pretty well in his in a little piece of his that we circulated, where he says, in the second paragraph, he says, although many of us are eager to follow the path to liberate ourselves from suffering, and we may even understand what our suffering is caused by, few of us pay attention to the view. The fact that we are not suffering, we have suffering. That was a very somewhat unusual, very interesting thing to say there. It's like right away, like make this differentiation between the idea that we are suffering versus that there is suffering or that we have suffering. And it's not immediately evident what that means by any means. And in that little simple statement, he's actually expressing a subtlety of the view that sort of ascends that hierarchy very, very quickly to some ultimate level, it seems.
I'm sorry, Derek. Could
Yeah.
you repeat that quote,
Yeah. So it
please?
was in one of the readings, preparatory readings for this class called The Foreword to the Introduction to the Middle Way, The View of Madhyamaka in Buddhism. And it's in the second paragraph, and he says, actually, that I'll read the sentence before. For example, when teaching the Four Noble Truths, Buddha taught that the fundamental truth, the view, is that we are not suffering. We merely have suffering. Therefore, by knowing the nature and cause of suffering, we can follow the path to liberate ourselves from suffering. It's like, what is the nuance he's trying to communicate there? What is the difference between suffering versus having suffering? By knowing the in the next sentence, it says, knowing the nature and cause of suffering, isn't he saying right there that we're suffering? And he's not. We can follow the path to liberate ourselves from suffering. Nonetheless, although many of us are eager to follow the path to liberate ourselves from suffering, and we may even understand what our suffering is caused by, few of us pay attention to the view, the fact that we are not suffering. We just have suffering. Because we do not understand the view, we still cling to primordial suffering. Therefore, no matter how much we practice and seek to apply methods to end our suffering, our path is not a middle path, a Madhyamaka path, a path beyond conceptual clinging. Instead, it ends up being an extreme path, a path of concepts, which will not liberate us from suffering. He has a wonderful ability to be outrageous and arrogant and completely true at the same time, completely profound. He's an amazing teacher. He also has this funny statement. Ultimately, our human tendency at the bottom of that first page is to be much more attracted to the methods of doing something rather than why we're doing it. The study of the view appears to be dry, boring, and long-winded, whereas anyone can just buy a cushion, sit on it, and after a few minutes feel satisfied that they've sat and meditated. In this age of materialism, people suffer from alienation and lack of purpose, and many people are seeking for something more. when there is so much seeking, there is a danger that a path specially designed to relieve temporal pain might come to overshadow the real path that uproots suffering, the true path to enlightenment.
Excuse me, Derek.
Yeah.
So in the three, four reliances, the one that seems a little tricky to me that I don't quite get is the discerning between provisional and definitive. Is this example you were just giving a little bit of a hint toward that?
It is. Thank you so much for bringing me back to to rely on the reliances. Yeah, so I was on the third one. And in my understanding, Dzongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche is pointing out the definitive, that the view is what understands the definitive meaning. And that definitive meaning is that we are not suffering. We are not. Our entity is not suffering. And we could go on some, either quickly or at some time, like, what does that mean? Why? But we have suffering. Or we give rise to suffering. It's to understand the causes and the nature of that suffering. But we are not suffering. That is not our nature. Our nature is not suffering. Our nature is, Emily, you're frozen. Oh, there you go. Your connection is not great. Do you want to chat it?
I'll chat it. Sorry about the internet.
And welcome, Lindsay. Great to see you. Thanks for joining us. So Emily's gonna dial in the answer to that. And the fourth, so that's the main project of this type of a course, is to understand the view, the nature of our suffering, the nature of our relationship to our suffering, and thereby understand how we can transform that situation. The fourth reliance, just to complete those, is rely on wisdom and not on consciousness. Which has a lot of, also has a huge amount of depth and meaning to it, and relates to the way that the view is put into meditation. Some traditions put conscious, a conceptual view into meditation. And the indication from the fourth reliance of relying on wisdom and not consciousness is to bring a non-conceptual, i.e. wisdom, view into our meditation practice. To understand the difference between what is consciousness, conceptual mind, conceptuality, conceptual artifice, the conceptual structure, and what is wisdom, the direct perception of the way things are. And so this course will focus on primarily this understanding of what the nature of reality is, in refining our view, and ideally we'll constantly be doing that from the point of view of how does that inform our meditation practice? How do we bring that into meditation? How do we bring view? And I think often when people ask that, they're looking for like very simple like implementation method, like, oh, I sit shamatha for 10 minutes and then I like bring the view into meditation. I don't think it's like that. I think it's much more organic. Let's see what Emily said. Emptiness. Thank you. So Emily was responding to what is our nature? Our nature is not suffering. Our nature is emptiness. My son has ADHD, and the advice for talking to a child about their diagnosis is to say anything that ADHD is something you have, it's not what you are. So they don't think of it as some fully entangled part of their identity that fully defines them and that they can never move beyond. Sorry about the internet. Thank you for that. That is very much the understanding of the definitive and what Tsongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche is getting at, and also a very skillful way of dealing with our minds, of understanding that it's a matter of like what has conditioned our minds. How did we get to be like the way we are? To be what we experience, as opposed to thinking that we are a certain way and are fixed in being a certain way.
Can I chime in for a bit?
Yeah, so please take it back
Thank
over, Chris.
you. I just wanted to riff on a few of the things that Derek was saying. And particularly this idea of provisional versus definitive, and that's an idea that goes back to the early Buddhist sutras. And so you have, as Derek mentioned, a wide range of schools who are going to interpret that quite differently. And we'll be looking at that, and that's actually what's going to be at the kind of what's at stake in a lot of the debates between the various traditions that we're going to be looking at. What's definitive, what's provisional? And these debates got quite heated. Teachings were repressed, schools were driven out to the boonies. But I would like to suggest that we could take a more ecumenical approach, and that from the time of the Buddha, nirvana, enlightenment, was spoken of as being beyond language, as ineffable. And so, anytime you're going to put it into language, as we do when we talk about it, and as we talk about what's the ultimate meaning, you're going to introduce some sort of distortion into the system, right? And so the one way of understanding the different traditions is understanding different, conventions on which distortions are acceptable and which aren't. So it could well be that, one of the main philosophical arguments we're going to be looking at, Rongtang versus Zhentong, these two schools could have the exact same enlightenment experience, but may have very different points of view about how you're allowed to talk about it and what sort of distortions are acceptable. So there's a tendency, I think, when studying what's called doxographies or sort of the hierarchy of views, to want to race to the top. Okay, this is wrong. That one's maybe a little better, but like, tell me what the real stuff is. And as we move through these, I want to invite us all to really taste what the different traditions have to offer, what they're inviting us to do and to contemplate, and to not necessarily sell them short, because from the point of view of our tradition, their view isn't adequate. So much of this, as Derek and I really learned when trying to put the course description together, comes down to disagreements about language, which language is appropriate. And it's a kind of like a marketing question, ultimately. So I just really want to keep an open mind, that what looks like a provisional view may not indicate necessarily that the people who held it had any less than a full realization. And then I guess while we're talking about readings and the material that we're going to be going through, I wanted to also caution against the tendency and desire for anachronism, projecting our own views into earlier schools, but to really take these traditions at their own word and try as much as we can. And we're going to be moving, even though this is, now three courses long, we're going to be moving relatively quickly through them. But to try and really take as much context as possible into the immediate circumstance. Derek talked about the Buddha giving his talks to specific audiences at specific times, and so much of understanding the Buddha's speech is involves understanding what those contexts were, who these people the Buddha was speaking to, and that's very similar with these, various traditions, understanding what came before them, who they're responding to. And we're going to try and do as much of that as we can in the short time that we have. And I think that when you drop out the projection of our time onto their time and, trying to get out of them what we want to, and appreciating them on their own terms, actually what we get is, through that hyperspecificity, a greater sense of universality. Things really open up to us and are much more relatable. So I just want to, sorry, my dogs. I just want to encourage everyone to, to just really taste this material for what it is. And simultaneously to not get too intimidated and put off by it. A lot of it's very unfamiliar language, really dense and difficult philosophical concepts, and to just not get bogged down by it. So that's my word of encouragement. Maybe we can look at the syllabus now, Derek.
Yeah, that would be pause for a minute, see if anyone has any comments.
So, Chris, were you kind of saying there might be a risk of reification if you get too caught up in the, or some level of conceit, even getting caught up in the, definitive, this is the definitive one and that kind of sort of thing, rather than being open to the,
Yes, I think that's certainly, throughout Buddhism, like the risk that we are always trying to be ever mindful of is reification.
I'm reminded of the progressive stages of meditation on emptiness. This third, between definitive and because it starts off at one school, and then the next school sort of refines that and takes it to another level, and then next thing you know, you've got Rangtong.
It sounds like a disease. Yeah, that's right. That's great. Thank you. And there's a tendency by the later schools, the adherents to look at the earlier schools and to think that the proponents of those views are lesser just because the views are lesser. And views are expressed based on sort of currently available conceptual frameworks, linguistic frameworks, terminology and philosophy and so forth. And it's very, very rare to make a big leap from one system to another. And for many people, we can't say the proponents of the earliest teachings didn't attain complete enlightenment. That would be a very arrogant and erroneous way of portraying things. Peter.
Yeah, so I just wanted to thank you, Chris, for pointing out that having us pause to think about not going too quickly in assessing some kind of value label to different schools, because the that actually puts a whole different light on it. The from a certain point of view, a provisional school is definitive. And if you ask, why is that so, then you have to sort of reveal what are the some basic assumptions that it has. And within those assumptions, then it's maybe in some sense definitive, but then you can see that those assumptions themselves, maybe we have to broaden them or let them go. But since we can, each one of us, we can live in different, sort of realms of assumptions, it's kind of revealing. It's kind of like a mirror to take a moment to really appreciate the worldview that comes with even a provisional view. I mean, from physics, we do this all the time. You have classical physics and quantum physics, and they're each consistent, but then one is sort of more consistent than the other. But you can appreciate the link when you can pause for a moment and look at the provisional meeting, the Truong at for a moment as valid. You can see it kind of reveals better the link to the to maybe a more encompassing view. So that was very helpful, your comment on having us pause and think about not going too quick.
I think there's a tendency to think that because the expression of the view is not sophisticated, then the practitioner did not achieve a high level of realization. But we know from the life stories of the Buddha that people he met on the spot, he was able to bring them into stream entry, the first stage of liberation on the path. And they didn't often develop a huge, a significant or deep level of sophistication in the view. But they just were able to see what they were fixated on and to let it go. And it's almost, ironically, it's actually almost the opposite, that those who have a more sophisticated view are thicker because they didn't get liberated with simpler views. I mean, if you're like a profound person, just the teaching of the Buddha to Bahia of like what is in the seeing, that is what's seen. There's nothing else. Don't project anything more than your eyes see colors. And that was enough for him to let go and achieve enlightenment. And so those of us that have this much more advanced and sophisticated view, it's almost like we're thicker and we need a more sophisticated conceptual framework for making progress in letting go. But I think at the end of the day, the process of engaging in that discipline of looking at fixation and trying to understand it from the point of view of releasing it is a very helpful process. Constantly being aware that there's a tendency to instead get lost in the details of how we're fixated and forget that letting go of fixation is the key. So we started with the beginning. We'll go through the syllabus briefly, and maybe I'll go through the sections, and Chris,
Can I just make one more point?
Please, yeah.
Talking about how thick we sophisticated intellectuals are, and probably everyone who signed up for this class suffers from this particular neurosis of, thinking very hard about things that could be quite simple. And I just I it's sort of another word of caution. And actually, if you've gotten your copy of the Golden Age of Buddhist Philosophy, Jan Westerhoff, in his introduction, he talks about philosophy as a game, And score, and the rules of the game and scoring different points. And I think it's very easy for us to become quite scholarly and turn this whole enterprise into a tremendous intellectual pursuit that has very little to do with our own immediate experience. But sort of a parlor game of trying to find the most sophisticated view. And it can be quite fun and seductive for nerdy people. And I just wanted to really make sure that we take to heart this whole idea, and that the view isn't, again, that there's a difference between a view and a theory, and that a view is something that's very personal. And ideally, as we move through this material, we'll really be spending some time looking at our own minds. What do I really believe to be true? I have a quote from Chögyam Trungpa that seems at least tangentially related I'd like to share. Many people try to find a spiritual path where they do not have to face themselves, but where they can still liberate themselves from themselves, in fact. In truth, this is impossible. We cannot do that. We have to be honest with ourselves. We have to see our guts, our real shit, our most undesirable parts. We have to see that. That is the foundation of warriorship and the basis of conquering fear. We have to face our fear. We have to look at it, study it, work with it, and practice meditation with it. So the idea is that we are really understanding the view on a personal level and asking ourselves, what do I think is true? Who do I think is me? What do I think is out there? Where do I draw the line? What do I think is ultimately real? Does the material that we're looking at in this class relate with that idea at all? How to what extent are these integrated or not? And just that is a series of questions to return to.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, so we'll all try to do that, keep returning to those questions. So where was that quote from?
Thank you. That's from Smile at Fear.
All right. That's great. Wonderful book by Trungpa Rinpoche. So let's take a quick look at the syllabus. That's the wrong one. Let's see if I can do the right share. Here we go. How's that? So next week we look at what the Buddha spoke about the view in what are traditionally held to be the earliest sutras. So we have a selection of six short, very short little early sutras, and a discussion of the origin of Madhyamaka and the Buddha silence. This excerpt from Wollstone Fletcher's introduction to his translation of Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka Avatara with commentary by Jonathan Nipon, and the famous 14 questions that the Buddha would not respond to. So, interestingly, the Buddha did not want to engage in a lot of the sort of intellectual or conceptual cultivation of the view that we're actually going to engage in this course. And that most Buddhist traditions have engaged in for hundreds of and thousands of years, actually. But he was very, very adamant to not get into speculation with other students at the time who wanted to pursue philosophical questions. Is there an end to the world? What happens after the end of the world? What happens when a Buddha dies? Where does a Buddha go? Is there a beginning to the world? Is there a be, you know, these, it's like, is there a beginning to time? Is there a beginning to samsara? Is there an end to time or samsara? And he was very practical in setting out the priority is understanding and letting go of fixation and its various ramifications. So we'll start there, and then we'll dive into what's known as the Abhidharma tradition. And the Abhidharma tradition develops a couple hundred years after the life of the Buddha. Even though the tradition has it that the Abhidharma was recited at the first council of the elders after the Buddha's parinirvana, it's pretty much universally accepted that the compilation of the Abhidharma basket of teachings from all schools of Buddhism did not happen for a couple hundred years after the life of the Buddha. And the legendary account of three arhats reciting the three baskets is an exaggeration, and that only the sutras and the Vinaya were recited. And there's a difference in the two main traditions of early Buddhism. One tradition holds that the Abhidharma texts were actually by the Buddha, and the other tradition holds that they were composed by major students of the Buddha, obviously based on his teaching. But in any way, what happens with the Abhidharma so-called project is the attempt to explain how things are and how they function. And we'll see that everything boils down in reality to two aspects, existence and functionality. What does it mean to say something exists? And how do things function? If they exist, how do they function? And the ramifications of that are huge for understanding everything else, such as karma, rebirth, confusion, liberation, and so forth. I gave here, let's see, we have a few classes on Abhidharma. And also, this book, The Golden Age of Buddhism, we'll use for the next part of this three-part series. So there may not be a lot from that book in this course, but there'll be more in the next course. We'll continue to use that book. And also, you'll see that a lot of this source book that's so huge, a lot of it is material that you can just sort of flip through. So we got about 15 pages here of just exhibits that are helpful to look at and understand, and we may refer to. And one of the reasons for that is having, wait, there's a detailed outline or a table of contents of this one particular text on Aruda's Abhidhammatasangaha. Because the Abhidharma texts are somewhat impenetrable, they're basically just descriptive lists of what is and how those things that are function. And there's very little general speculation or description of those. Instead, they dive immediately down to the specifics. And so that's why we focus instead on secondary literature by scholars, contemporary scholars. So this first article by Noah Ronkin, and then the material by Jan Westerhoff, where he goes through particulars of certain of the main schools of the Abhidharma tradition, and then some presentations on these core topics of existence, and in particular of how, what does it mean for something to exist? Whereas basically the rest of the course we're focusing on source material in translation. This is an odd segment where the source material is somewhat impenetrable. And so instead we're using secondary literature. And then we shift into the middle way, the Madhyamaka tradition. And in each section, we'll see here, and then in subsequent parts of this three-part course, we'll start off with the sutra basis. And so here in the Buddha's middle way, we have a little introduction to the development, some background by Wollstone Fletcher and his wonderful introduction, overview of the development of the Madhyamaka tradition. And then we have three sutras. Actually, sort of not a sutra, sorry, a praise by this gentleman, Rahula Bhadra, who's said to be Nagarjuna's teacher, an elusive gentleman, if ever. Be interesting, this idea of him being Nagarjuna's teacher. And then we, which Chris contributed, and apparently this is supposed to be recited before you study the Prajnaparamita literature. And then we have two main sutra examples from the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines, a couple of chapters, and then from the sutra of Vimalakirti's questioning. So we get a taste for one of the sutra presentations of the ultimate reality or the nature of reality and from the Buddha's, from what's attributed to the Buddha. And then we go to the main figure of the Madhyamaka tradition, Nagarjuna. We have some background introductory discussion by Jan from the book, The Golden Age, and then we focus in on his main beef, which is, what is Svabhava? Svabhava is self-nature. What is existence? Where he challenges the Abhidharma view of existence and basically reveals that any way you slice it, existence, true existence, real existence, is ineffective, cannot function. So we have these two aspects of existence and functionality. What exists and what happens to what exists? Those two aspects of our world. What exists and what happens to what exists? And he basically concludes that if you believe that anything exists, then they can't do anything. Nothing can happen to them. Pretty radical leap that he makes. And we'll look at his cortex, the Karikas on the middle way. In particular, chapter one, examination of conditions, which is really an examination of causation, functionality. How can things function if they actually exist? They can't function. And that topic is the main topic throughout the remainder of the Madhyamaka tradition, from India to Tibet, is that first, what's covered in that first chapter of Nagarjuna's Karikas. And then we have a few other excerpts from key texts, that same one, another chapter and another text. And then we go into Nagarjuna's successors, the two main successors, a little introductory material by the book, Jan Westerhoff and Wollstone, about the basically three gentlemen that come after, major figures that come after Nagarjuna and his tradition. And then we go through them. Buddhapalita, the first of those three, who later becomes known as the source for the Prasangika tradition of Madhyamaka, the consequence school. And we'll look at his commentary on that first chapter of Nagarjuna's Karikas. And then secondly, we'll look at Bhava Viveka, who's the second one who criticizes Buddhapalita's presentation and says, well, you don't really explain it well enough for people to have the chance to accept it, to understand it and accept it. So he sets about his way of explaining Nagarjuna's Mula Vinyamaka Karika, and we'll look at a portion of his first chapter, which is very long. I've given the whole chapter in the book, in the source book, but we'll just look at a few pages from that, the key section on causal conditions. And then we look at Chandrakirti, who comes after those two, and looks at Nagarjuna. He looks at Nagarjuna, looks at Buddhapada, Bhavavaveka, these two guys, main proponents after Nagarjuna, who disagree with each other. And Chandrakirti says, I'm going to go with Buddhapada. And so he lays out his tradition in support of Buddhapada in his introduction to the Middle Way in the sixth chapter, where he focuses on causal production. How can production of any real entity ever happen? And his whole text is really based on going through causation. And he has another text where he actually gives a commentary on Nagarjuna's Karikas, and we'll look at part of his commentary on chapter one of Nagarjuna's Karikas, and see how he is separating these two commentators of Nagarjuna, Buddhapada, and Bhavaveka as being two different traditions, and his siding with Buddhapada. So, Chris, do you want to go through the same thing? Or flesh out more of it, or what would you like to add?
I don't want to bore people to tears, particularly. One thing I do want to mention is quite interesting. We scroll back down to Chandrakirti. So something, a motif of this class is the way that things just get unraveled over time and developed and with the Chandra, so Chandrakirti is writing a commentary on Nagarjuna, and we'll be looking at I guess it looks like 42 lines of from his Madhyamaka Vatara, and those 42 lines are his commentary on 4 lines of Nagarjuna. And then we have Jan Westerhoff, 30 pages of his commenting on Chandrakirti. So I just it's it, I find it so interesting the way that these this material is sort of constantly generative and sort of gets interpreted and reinterpreted over time, which of course is what we'll be doing in this class. It's like the old is the new, and the new is the old. And maybe, Derek, if we could talk a little bit about the following two classes, just briefly, where this is all going and what will come after this. And we don't have to pull up the syllabuses or anything, but speaking just generally about how this fits into the overall view of this program we're doing.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thanks for that, Chris. So we'll continue this trajectory of going through the major commentators on the view in the Buddhist tradition by next looking at Asanga, sorry, Maitreya, Asanga, and Vasubandhu, and what becomes called the Yogacara tradition of Buddhism. And we'll start with some sutras again, and then we'll look at texts by those three individuals in order, Maitreya, Asanga, and Vasubandhu. And then we'll come to the gentleman who's famous for synthesizing the two traditions of Madhyamaka together, Shantarakshita, in the 8th century, who is invited by King Trisong Detsen to bring the Dharma into Tibet in the late 700s, the late 8th century. And the one who struggles to build the first monastery at Sanye, and who encounters a lot of local opposition and suggests to the king, oh, you need some heavy dude, like some tantric master here. A scholar and a monastic. We need like a politician or whatever you want to call him. And he recommends Padmasambhava, and the king sets out a mission, and the rest is history. But Shantarakshita is famous for bringing these two traditions together in a text called The Ornament of Madhyamaka, the Middle Way, Madhyamaka Alamkara. And that basically becomes the scheme of Buddhism in Tibet for about 300 years, 200 to 300 years. That sort of syncretic way of viewing the Svatantrika of Bhavaviveka's version of Madhyamaka and Buddhapada's version, which is a very interesting historical situation, because in this early period, Chandrakirti's text is translated, but for some reason it's not really noticed that much. It doesn't have that much influence on the situation. And then there's a persecution of Buddhism in Tibet. And in the meantime, we shift back to India, where there's another development in the Mahayana Buddhism in India known as the Tathagatagarbha tradition, the Buddha nature tradition. And we begin with some sutras, in particular the Tathagatagarbha Sutra. And we look also at Maitreya's commentary on the Buddha nature teaching, which strangely, while Maitreya gave 5 texts to a Sangha, including this Buddha nature text and a text called Distinguishing Dharma from Dharmata, which we did a course on a few years ago, or a year ago. They remain miraculously unheard of, or receive very little attention. There's like no commentaries on them in India, one or two maybe commentaries on them in India. And then we're given the story that Maitreya, who, as you might remember, is one of the two teachers of Marpa. Marpa goes to India 3 times to meet with his teacher, Naropa, and he asks for the teachings of Mahamudra, and Naropa, although he has those, of course, sends them to Maitreya as being like the main proponent of the Mahamudra tradition from Sarha. Who supposedly is a student of Nagarjuna. And Maitreya has apparently discovered these texts that were hidden, these two Maitreya texts that were hidden in a pillar of some monastery. And he sees like some light peeking through a crack in the pillar. And I don't think they had like electricity back then, so it was a little odd to see light coming out of a pillar. And he decides it requires further investigation, and opens up, finds these two texts, and suddenly the Buddha nature text becomes very prominent. So we'll look at that, and a little bit about how the absence of a Tathagatagarbha tradition in India is very odd. There's these sutras, but it doesn't really gain recognition or momentum much in India. Then we shift back to Tibet, and after the persecution by King Longdharma, Buddhism slowly comes back. Utisha is one of the main proponents early on, and right around the same time as Utisha, there's a gentleman who has gone to India, and I'm a little vague on his story, but he basically retranslates Chandrakirti's Introduction to the Middle Way and is very successful at promoting this text, and like makes a big deal of it as being the ultimate authentic authoritarian version of the Middle Way. And he's very persuasive, and basically all of Tibetan Buddhism becomes focused on Chandrakirti's presentation of Madhyamaka as the Prasangika, as being the ultimate level of Madhyamaka. And instead of there being this focus on the synthesis of the two by Shantarakshita, we get what we see today of this hierarchical classification of the Abhidharma tradition, the Yogacara, and then the Svatantrika and the Prasangika tradition. Atisha is a proponent of that scheme. We'll see his version of presentation on these issues. And then there's what's called the Renaissance of Tibetan of Buddhism in Tibet, where suddenly in about the 14th century, there's a great blossoming of a huge number of teachers, of major teachers at the pretty much at the same time. Tsongkhapa, one of the most famous, creates the Gelugpa tradition from the Kadampa tradition of Atisha. There's the Sakya tradition, comes into flower and actually has temporal rule of Tibet, as well as a large influence on the philosophical landscape, in particular through Sakya Pandita. And there's Longchenpa in the Nyingma tradition, probably regarded as the greatest philosopher practitioner of Tibet. And then we have Rongchen Dorje, the third Karmapa, all roughly in the same century, which is pretty amazing and all. And then one other gentleman named Dolpopa, who is hugely popular, just masses of people as students, promoting the Kala Chakra teachings, which have started circulating in about the 10th or 11th century in Tibet, through yogis going from India to Tibet with them. And he focuses on the Kala Chakra tradition and comes up with a completely radical version of Madhyamaka that he calls the Zhentong, the other emptiness tradition. And so the term Rongtong is sort of created later as the counterpart to his Zhentong tradition. But he puts forward this really wonderful way of looking at all of the major players that came before him differently than the tradition has viewed them for centuries. So he looks at Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti as being Zhentongpas, which is quite a feat. So we'll look at his core texts, the Fourth Council. And so we have these five traditions, the four main schools as we know them, plus Dolpopa's tradition that becomes known as the Jonang. And in the last of their three courses, we'll look at how those traditions further develop over a few centuries, some major players in those traditions, and finally end up with Mipham. And we'll look first at his what's called Lion's Roar of Buddha Nature. So he wrote two texts with the title Buddha, Lion's Roar in them. One is the Lion's Roar of Buddha Nature, which we did do a course on a number of years ago, really wonderful presentation of Buddha nature. Very profound subtlety in how to understand Buddha nature without reifying it, without either undercutting it, sort of denying it any credence, like considering that as a provisional teaching, as some schools of Buddhism in Tibet do, view Buddha nature as provisional, nor viewing Buddha nature as an extreme reality, on the other extreme as a sort of reified entity. And he cuts a very, very subtle path between those two in the understanding of Buddha nature. And then finally, we'll spend a few classes on his Lion's Roar of Other Emptiness, of Zhentong, and see if, based upon what we've been through, we can unpack that text. Fine. So that's the plan, and it's a lot of material, and we've tried to focus it down so it's not much more than 20 pages per class, and we'll try in classes to focus on smaller amounts, smaller portions of those. Ideally, we'll send out during the week in the reading reminder, like, here's the full reading. Focus in particular on these, like, 5 to 10 pages would be ideal. And important material that we don't get to, we'll try to catch it the next week. And so we do have a week at the end for a so-called review that historically has always been used to just catch up. And
Are you still on the class? Okay. I wanted to discuss this. This is, I don't know whose card.
and so changes came back. Any final contributions, thoughts? Chris, do you want to add anything before we open it to others? Or Patrick?
It sounds like a lot, but I think we're moving through it very fast. As I said before, and just want to, make some gesture at the material that we're leaving out, which is an enormous amount. A lot of the tradition that we have been handed down comes down from monastics. These are the people who were able to study, who had the privileges and resources to do that. So we're leaving out, householders who, make up a long stream of practitioners. Such as ourselves. And then the other thing is that we're pretty much, as far as I can tell, we're only reading men. And that is not to say that women were not part of this tradition or making important contributions philosophically and otherwise. But that again has to do a lot with who had power in these institutions and who was able to write texts and which ones got passed down. So I just wanted to make some gesture at that.
That's huge. Thank you so much for that. And the idea, I think, is that we change those trends now, right? And we shift it so that women are prominent and do become prominent teachers now and in the future, and householders also become prominent contributors to the discourse and the development of the tradition headed up by women. Any other comments, suggestions, questions?
Just on the view, when you were talking about don't over-intellectualize it and stuff, I was thinking, well, it's a combination. It's intellectual and experiential. And I get that when I slow down my reading. So I'm glad that you pointed out that you're going to have a focus on this part, because sometimes I just slow down and experience the reading instead of trying to intellectualize it and understand it.
That's great. Hopefully, we'll come up with ideally, we'll forge a middle path of those two, with those two, or between those two extremes. Anyone else? Final last words? Okay, well, thank you all very much. So just those who are new to Rimei Shaizha, so the recordings are posted on the website. If you haven't looked at the website, check that out. There's the source book, and well, any other handouts, which there probably will be, will eventually go up there, thanks to Morgan, as well as the recording. And the source book, I sent you a link to download it as one file. It's large, it's very large, to put it on Squarespace, the website. We had to split it. So if you see that, don't be surprised and think that's something different. It's just the same thing split in two. And to conclude, we just do the dedication chants that are traditional in the tradition of Trungpa Rinpoche. So, for those who may not be familiar with it, I'll screen share that if I can. Yeah. By this merit may all attain omniscience, may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara. May I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, everyone. Thank you very much, especially to Chris.
Thank you.
Finally doing it. Very much looking forward to going through this material and doing it with all of you. Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you. Sounds very interesting.